You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Last week, we read a big chunk of Matthew's birth narrative, and as that doesn't often happen in church, many of you were surprised to have heard what was in it. As I got a lot of positive feedback and a bunch more questions, it seemed appropriate to go ahead and share another birth narrative from which we get a lot of the details of the Christmas story, but surprise, is not actually in the Bible. Turns out that a lot of the details people assume are in the Christmas story are actually from extra-biblical sources like our reading today. Excerpts from the Infancy Gospel of James, also known as the Proto-Evangelium of James. Probably written in the late 2nd to maybe even the early 3rd century, we don't know who the author was, but it was probably written for a Syrian or Palestinian audience of Greek-speaking Christians who were anxious about Mary's reputation as the whole veneration of Mary tradition was taking root. This infancy gospel is where we get Mary on a donkey, not in the Bible, Joseph as an elderly widower with kids from a previous marriage, also not in the Bible, and is why you often see Jesus' birthplace portrayed as a cave, not in the Bible. This graphic is a good mashup of the Gospels. The scene is in a cave, from James, which also is a stable, from Luke, with two of Joseph's sons in attendance, from James. These alleged older brothers are not in the Bible, but had to be created by those advocating for Mary's perpetual virginity in order to account for Mark, Matthew, and John mentioning Jesus' brothers. Listen for the details in the story, like when the narration changes from third person to first person narration from Joseph, suggesting different sources. And note the mention of how Joseph won Mary in the lottery. That whole story is earlier in this text. Also, listen for the humor, like the moment the midwife sounds remarkably modern and responds to Joseph's claims of Mary's virginity with, "Really?" There are many sections of this story we're not reading today, like when the midwife is skeptical about Mary's virginity and does a physical forensic inspection only to have her hand wither for unbelief. Not exactly the kind of thing you see portrayed in typical nativity scenes, but such details were important in the developing cult of Mary worship. Don't believe she's a virgin? Your hand just may wither away! It's really a shame that the infancy gospel of both Thomas and the book from which our reading is taken today are not included in our official canon. A shame because they're all a rich and beautiful part of the tradition from which we get a number of images we take for granted as part of the Christmas stories.
Our words of wisdom are selections from the Infancy Gospel of James 17 through 19.
Then there was an order from the Emperor Augustus to register how many people were in Bethlehem of Judea. And Joseph said, "I will register my sons, but this child, what will I do about him? Will I register him and my wife? Oh, I am ashamed. Should I register her as my daughter? The children of Israel know that she is not my daughter. This day I will do as the Lord wants."
And he saddled his donkey and sat her on it, and his son led, and Samuel followed. And they arrived at the third mile, and Joseph turned and saw that she was sad. And he said to himself, "Perhaps the child within her is troubling her."
When they came to the middle of the journey, Mary said to him, "Joseph, take me off the donkey, the child pushing from within me to let him come out. So he took her off the donkey and said to her, where will I take you and shelter you in your awkwardness? This area is a desert.
And he found a cave and led her there and stationed his sons to watch her while he went to find a Hebrew midwife in the land of Bethlehem.
And I saw a woman coming down from the mountain, and she said to me, man, where are you going? And I said, I am seeking a Hebrew midwife. Replying, she said to me, are you from Israel? And I said to her, yes.
Then she said, and who is giving birth in this cave? And I said, the one who has pledged to be married to me. And she said to me, she is not your wife. And I said to her, she is Mary, the one who was raised in the temple. I won her by lot to be my wife. She is not yet my wife, but has a fetus from the Holy Spirit. And the midwife said, really?
And Joseph said to her, come and see. So the midwife went with him, and they stood near the cave, and a dark cloud was hovering over the cave. And the midwife said, my soul glorifies this day, for today my eyes have seen a miracle. Salvation has come to Israel.
And immediately the cloud withdrew from the cave, and a great light appeared in the cave, so that their eyes could not bear it. And a little while later, the same light withdrew until an infant appeared. And he came and took the breast of his mother Mary. And the midwife cried out and said, how great this day is for me, for I have seen this new miracle.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
A number of years ago, the Fountains kids put on the Christmas pageant, Matt and Lucy's Virgin Births. The play opens with Matt and Lucy volunteering to help with what they think is a regular Christmas pageant. The director asks them to run the rehearsal while she takes care of some last-minute details. Little do they know that the director gives them each a different script. As the shepherds wander on to sing their song, Matt is desperately fumbling through his script, unable to find mention of them. Hey, who are these guys? Lucy calmly points out that they're right there on page 2 of her script. Then come the wise men, and it's Lucy's turn to have a conniption. Hey, there are no wise men in my script. So the play goes on with conflicting storylines, characters, and settings. Matt and Lucy, stand-ins for Matthew and Luke, become increasingly frustrated until, as the play ends, the director explains how having two different stories gives us an appreciation of the diversity of ways that early Christians expressed their understanding of who Jesus was. Unfortunately, most Christians have been allowed and encouraged to synthesize the two stories into one. It makes for a nice crèche, but it doesn't reflect what's actually in the Bible and the intentions of those who offered us two very different birth narratives to show how Jesus was interpreted by two different communities. Instead of two rich parables, we've chosen Cuisinart, blended to mush, and worse, defended as historically accurate. And what happened to James' version? Evidently, it didn't fit, or it didn't have the right lobbyists to make the final cut. But its influence lives on despite the best efforts of the establishment. Truth be told, we don't know where, how, or really anything about Jesus' birth. Certainly not on December 24th or 25th. That's Mithra's birthday, a celebration adopted by Christians in order to fit into Roman culture. most people don't realize and are indignant at the suggestion that, according to the text, as we discovered when reading it last week, Matthew portrays the family living in Bethlehem. There's no census. There are no shepherds. Herod and the wise men are the backstory, and most of the action is meant to portray Jesus as the new Moses, an appeal to Matthew's predominantly Jewish audience. It was in Luke where the family lived in Nazareth and had to travel to Bethlehem. Shepherds and angels were in attendance, but no star. That's Matthew. And of course, there's no birth story at all in our earliest New Testament writings from Paul and Mark, or in the much later Gospel of John, either. Why didn't Paul and Mark write about Jesus' miraculous birth when they were writing in the 50s and the 70s? Probably because Matthew and Luke hadn't made the stories up yet. And here's the thing. As Jesus' teaching spread throughout the empire, his reputation came into direct competition with other religious figures. And before you know it, stories began to develop about Jesus' birth that would have sounded very familiar to pagans and Romans. By the 80s, various versions of Jesus' miraculous birth were widespread, and along came Matthew and Luke, who incorporated two of these versions into their Gospels. Stories that sounded similar to the births of pagan deities and were sure to enhance Jesus' credibility in the competitive world of first century God-men. Years later, along comes the Gospel of John. A virgin birth is not good enough for John. Oh, no! John places Jesus' origin before creation itself. Jesus is associated cosmically with light itself. Now, this may seem like an odd jump, but not when you remember that every winter solstice, the Romans would have been celebrating Saturnalia, or Sol Invictus, the festival of the unconquered sun. On the longest night of the year, pagans gathered to shout, "Hooray!" It may seem like the darkness will triumph, but we know better. The sun will return. So here we are, 21 centuries later, continuing that pagan tradition. Last night was the longest night of the year, and this morning we mark the winter solstice. Astronomically speaking, for the next 3 days, the sun appears to stand still before reversing course on, you guessed it, Jesus' birthday. What an astrophysicist would call the maximum southern declination of the sun, the mythmakers of Egyptian, Roman, Mithraic, and now Christian religions have steeped in meaning. The sun lay in the darkness of the tomb, only to return triumphant on the third day. Sound familiar? What perfect imagery for John to apply to Jesus. The light will triumph, because Jesus is the light of the world. Now, this kind of connection may have contributed years later, as Rome transitioned to Christianity, to Christians adopting Saturnalia as a celebration of celebrating Jesus' birth. A perfect occasion to celebrate the birthday of the one who was to bring light into the world. All of which is more proof, as you may or may not know, that I am a reprobate, doomed to hell. At least, that's what most of the other clergy in town tell their people. Why? They claim I'm not Bible-believing. Fine, I'm not Bible-believing, but I advocate Bible reading, and I think that's what really scares people. The last thing you want to do, if you're a Christian, is actually read the Bible.
But why are you trying to destroy Christmas?
Folks, I'm not trying to destroy anything. If you want to continue to believe that God is going to love you because you steadfastly embrace the sweet, highly edited, saccharine story of literal virgins and magic stars that most of the world clings to, that's fine. I'm here to tell you that there's so much more to the story. As we discovered last week in actually reading the Matthew version of the Nativity, the Christmas stories have deep, challenging messages for a modern, mature faith. If you don't read what's actually there, you'll miss it. What I'm telling you is not some sort of evil and malicious speculation or the work of woke liberal scholars. No, this has been taught in seminaries for nearly 150 years. Even Catholic scholars John Meyer and Raymond Brown, writing under the Pope's imprimatur, have concluded that the infancy narratives are not historical, but parables, vehicles for the promotion of Christianity. That's a nice way of saying propaganda. So, I stand with the majority of pastors, priests, scholars, and theologians who represent the bulk of mainline and Catholic opinion. You can come with us, or you can stay where you were when you were 10 years old. As for me, far from it being the end to my faith, this understanding has helped me embrace my faith in a whole new and deeper way. The bottom line is that who Jesus was and is not dependent on a miraculous birth story. When you come right down to it, all the fuss about virgins and angels proclaiming a divine birth is just a distraction from Jesus' genuine message. And clearly, many Christians would rather argue about doctrine than actually respond to the call to follow Jesus. And the way that call is expressed by Matthew and Luke is clear from the very beginning of their Gospels. Biblical scholar Amy Jill Levine says, "So what Luke is saying is not so much, here's how Mary and Joseph landed in Bethlehem. What Luke is asking is, what sort of kingdom do we want? What sort of son of God do you want? Do you want Augustus, the son of God, sitting on the throne in Rome, who was taxing the colonies and forcing people to disrupt their lives for the sake of the empire? Or do you want a son of God born in a stable, whose idea of economy is forgive us our debts as we forgive those who are indebted to us? You choose." That's the message. It's profoundly political and economic. And yes, even the terms Son of God and Prince of Peace are political. Why? Because Caesar Augustus was called the Son of God, Savior, Lord, and the Prince of Peace long before Jesus ever was. So to call Jesus any of these titles was downright treason. As Dom Crossan has said, Gentile converts came from a world where nearly every founder of a religion was born of a virgin, not to mention the rulers, Caesars, pharaohs, and various sundry other figures. For Jesus to not have been born of a virgin would have been out of the ordinary. So where does that leave us? Christmas, shattered. Ruined. Jesus, just born the old normal way. Yeah? As the politician's non-apology apology goes, I'm sorry if anyone is offended. It's been said that the job of a pastor is to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. So today, I'm comforting those who have always known there's more to the meaning of Christmas than doting on a cute baby, and against all rational thought, having to believe it was by a miracle. And if doing so is afflicting to those who think that virgin births and guiding stars is all there is to it, then so be it. Be afflicted. Look, light, happiness, joy, generosity, family, these are all good things to embrace at Christmas. But they're easy compared to the main thing. Jesus coming into the world is a call to do justice, to work to realize God's vision for humanity, to heal the world. And that doesn't happen by itself. You've heard the fancy word for Jesus being the human expression of divinity, incarnation. From the same Latin root, we get chili con carne, chili with meat. The most important thing to remember about Christmas is that this incarnation is not just about Jesus, not just about some winding miracle that happened 2,000 years ago. It's about us today putting meat on the gospel. In the words of Dr. Cornel West, never forget that justice is what love looks like in public. Put some flesh on the Christmas story. It's not about, as Mark Twain said, believing a bunch of stuff you know ain't so. It's more what Marcus Borg reminded us of. The Christian life is about being in a relationship with a mystery, a more, call the divine what you will, that transforms us into more and more compassionate beings, into the likeness of Christ. Imperfect and frail as we may be, our call as followers of Jesus is to make God's grace real in the world, to be on about confronting the principalities and the powers that oppress and exclude the voiceless. Each of us is a clumsy mix of good and bad, assumptions, prejudices, and good intentions. Yet we are who God is depending on to be Christ's ears, eyes, hands, and heart. The gospel writers tried to get people's attention with angels and stars and virgin births. Councils tried to distract us with formulas and creeds, and preachers have tried to convince us that we are so evil that we need to bathe in the spilled blood of Jesus. But in the end, we are finally left with what Jesus evidently had himself, the call to make the love of God real in the world. So, may your Christmas be filled with all the angels, virgins, and donkeys your heart desires. But may its deeper message be loud and clear. We are called to put love first in the world, putting flesh on Jesus' vision, here and now. Merry Mithras, and happy Sol Invictus. And be well. Hey, and don't forget, if you like what you heard today, buy me a coffee. Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information, or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.fountains.org. weputlovefirst.org.